Okay, well, now that we know some reasons why Ford Foundation and AID were involved, how then did the University of Wisconsin become the principal school involved in this project, in the Northern Nigeria Teacher Education Project?
Well, the Ford Foundation had made a grant to the University of Wisconsin of approximately $4.5 million to carry on developmental activities in countries around the world. The grant from the Ford Foundation was to the University of Wisconsin to carry on research and development programs in various fields, and there were no strings attached as to the areas to be emphasized. In other words, the university authorities had complete autonomy. Naturally, the possibilities of developing long-range programs in Africa, Asia, and Latin American countries were unlimited, and the university sent forward its senior authorities were interested in the exploration and development planning. And I remember when Professor Henry Hill, director of the Office of International Studies at Wisconsin, came to Nigeria, and he was interested in exploring with the Nigerians the opportunities in institution building, looking to the prospects of assisting or cooperating with the Nigerians in university-wide development. Interestingly enough, this avenue did prove to be a very fruitful avenue for exploration, and the University of Wisconsin became involved in the development of the University of Ife from scratch, and this university is located in western Nigeria. The university was also keenly interested in the prospects of joining in partnership with the Nigerians, the building of a major program in teacher education for northern Nigeria, and Dean Lindley Stiles was the exploring authority who came out to Nigeria and spent a fortnight in discussing prospects with the Nigerian authorities. The Northern Nigerian Teacher Education Project, sponsored primarily by the Ford Foundation, did not come to finalized contract position until after I had returned to the Madison campus of the University of Wisconsin. This was in late 1964. And the development programs on the University of Ife in agriculture and other fields did not come into focus until later in the 60s.
Let me clarify a couple of things. First of all, the $4.5 million you spoke of was university-wide, not just school education.
This was university-wide, and the coordinator for the development planning under the grant was in Professor Henry Hill's hands.
Mm-hmm. Was this grant given while you were in Nigeria?
This grant must have come in 1961. I can remember discussing the scope of the charter under which the grant was made here on campus in 1960. And it came, the grant was made just shortly before I went to Nigeria in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And it was university-wide.
The question in my mind still remains, why did Wisconsin choose Nigeria? Was that because you were there and they had that knowledge, that little bit of connection to it already?
Well, good question. I think that Wisconsin was attracted to Nigeria as a very, very promising developing nation. In the period 1960 and 61, right after Nigerian independence, Lagos, Nigeria, was a kind of crossroads in Africa for all those representing foreign interests who were concerned with the development of West Africa. It brought droves of experts from every walk of life, from the business world, from the technical professional fields of agriculture, engineering, and those interested in institutional development in education, including elementary, secondary, technical, and higher education. And the magnitude of the interests is well represented when you realize that in teacher education, University of Wisconsin came as the major partner. In secondary education, Harvard University and UCLA came. Harvard in the development of a very large secondary school in western Nigeria, and UCLA came in connection with the development of a large secondary school in eastern Nigeria at Port Harcourt. Nation of Nigeria was, from independence time, recognized as an extremely promising nation because it had human resources, very ambitious, pleasantly aggressive, eager to get on with the homework, involved in nation building. And in those very early times of Nigerian independence, the explorations in the oil realm were already showing rather promising possibilities,
mm-hmm.
which have later come on, of course, to make Nigeria independent financially?
Well, I know that.
I think in direct answer to your questions, perhaps I served as a liaison between the stateside interests, thinking in terms of universities, and that I stood ready to give counsel to those American representatives who wanted to explore and chart out the possibilities of becoming long-range partners with Nigeria. This was true in the case of the University of Wisconsin, my home base, and also true with other American universities, including Harvard and UCLA and Pittsburgh and the University of Kansas over there and with various interests.
I know that you resigned from the university midway during the project and went on to work for AID in the eastern part of the world, and then later came back to Africa. But perhaps because of your experience and AID, you could, from that perspective at least, give some evaluation of the results of those projects, particularly the Wisconsin project.
Well, I think that the records probably provide the best basis for evaluation. As one person who was fairly well acquainted with the Nigerian situation, I was very happy to see a major American university with the strength that the University of Wisconsin has come into the Nigerian frontier. I finished my two-year tour in Nigeria under a very tight agreement between the University of Wisconsin and the United States government, and came back to my responsibilities here on the home campus. If I had been footloose, I might very well have been enticed into a long, long, long term as advisor in human resources development business in Nigeria. But I came back after serving my 2 years and was prepared to get back into the stride in teaching and research in the comparative and international education fronts. And I had been here on the home campus only about 6 months when an urgent request came through U.S. government channels for me to go to Korea as an educational advisor. And I visited with a number of authorities in the university who had had experience in the Far East, and a couple who had had experience in Korea. And the message was to accept the invitation that never again would I get the opportunity to see a nation skyrocket into economic security and development. And one of my major counselors was President Fred Harrington, who had done his doctor's thesis on Korea. And I hadn't the slightest intention of expanding my range of experiences in the international sector beyond India and Nigeria. But the Korea situation seemed to have unlimited possibilities, and the university authorities, gracious as ever, readily approved the 2-year leave, so I went to Korea, and my major concentration there was on assisting the Koreans in developing a national commission for long-range planning and education. And at the end of 2 years, the Koreans were right in midstream in the business of developing their national commission, and I felt compelled to stay on for professional reasons to see this business through, and this seemed to me to be requiring at least one more year. And I also knew at that time that another great opportunity was coming in Indonesia, when Indonesia would turn to the United States and request extensive advisory and economic assistance. And so I felt it important to be perfectly honest with the university authorities and say, these are my prime interests. I appreciate so much all that the University of Wisconsin has done for and with me, both as a student and as a faculty member. And I think I must be honest and say that I'm going to request permanent leave from the university and simultaneously request appointment as a permanent Foreign Service officer with the U.S. government. There were certain aspects of the work in Korea and in Indonesia which required that I be in full status as a Foreign Service officer and on a long-term basis. So this explains, in brief, my severing those long and precious ties with the University of Wisconsin. Actually, I felt that although officially, on paper, the ties were broken, that they never have been broken. I still feel very much a part of the University of Wisconsin family, and always will.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to see them from your vantage point in the Foreign Service some years later, I guess, when you came back to Washington, to see the fruits that the work in Nigeria that Wisconsin had brought, if any?
Well, the last year and a half of my work in the Foreign Service, out of the headquarters in Washington, D.C., provided opportunity for me to work directly with the representatives of the major higher education associations in the United States. And the focus was on helping the national associations, which represent some 3,000 American higher education institutions, organize for the development of what they call enduring alliances with their counterparts in higher education around the world, working on the frontiers in research and development and teaching and writing, always looking to the mutual benefits that can accrue. And this, I would hasten to point out, is a vastly different approach than that which we took from the American institution side in the late 40s and the 1950s, where the American institution, or cluster of institutions, usually saw themselves in the senior partner mature position of making the precious contributions as the senior partner and making them in a fairly short time band of 2 to 5 years and then withdrawing and coming home, so to speak, and going about the important business of working in the United States. So I feel that the work on the part of the American institutions has moved from that short-term contract operation, which was characteristic of the work in the early years in India in the early 1950s, clear over to a full open-ended long-range partnership of higher education institutions around the world, always looking to mutual benefits accruing, as opposed to the senior institutions giving great counsel and guidance to the junior institutions in the underdeveloped countries. And all of this fits in very well to the United Nations family, mm-hmm. whether it's UNESCO or the Food and Agriculture Council, or the World Health Organization, or the UNICEF, where the less developed nations and the more highly developed nations tend to sit together as equals.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe it would be appropriate to, at this point, raise one more question, which is a question that some people would raise who would be interested in interpreting the University of Wisconsin's role in development of other countries. And I'm sure that this has appeared for you, and I think you ought to have a chance to speak to it. Some people would say that, well, here's a person who came from the university, very highly thought of both by the university and by the Foreign Service, who advised a number of countries on how they might go about bettering their educational systems. Three of the countries, certainly, at least in recent years, have appeared to be relatively repressive and undemocratic regimes, particularly Korea and Indonesia, to a lesser extent perhaps India. Some people would ask then, did the advice that you give these countries, did the kind of educational system that you helped them devise aid them in their policies, political policies, or did it in some way weaken their control, or did you feel that that was an independent part of the entire picture?
Well, this is a pretty complex and difficult business to address in short order. In India, I guess I must do it maybe ticking off one country at a time.
Okay.
In India, you have truly a vast subcontinent. And it is often said that change comes so slowly in Indian society. Some cited this in the 1950s to argue that communism could never make any substantial headway in India because change just doesn't come rapidly. I remember an Indian friend in a very high position pointing out to me that it was quite difficult to remove the cows from the streets in Indian cities because the Indian society had spent 1,500 years in building the cow into the society very substantially, protecting that animal as you would protect a human being. And the modern developed world was demanding free passage in the streets of a large city like Bombay or Calcutta, and to suddenly, within a 10-year span, say, you've got to get the cows out of the road, didn't make very good sense when it took 1,500 years to build them in. And one might go on to indicate that the foundations for democracy are indeed quite secure in India because you have the, in every local Indian community, and there are over 600,000 villages in India, you have the grassroots of democracy. You have what is known as the village board or the panchayat. And here you have democracy functioning in that you have the wise man or the council of wise people of the community directing the affairs of that unit of society in a very democratic frame in most instances. And so you might hope that the lurching in India more to what appeared in recent times as a rather autocratic iron hand at the center would be just a passing shadow, as a cloud might pass over the sun for a moment, and that you would get a refreshing and cleansing and a movement in, say, 20 or 30 or 40 years, back to democratic operations, as were present when India came into independence. In the case of Korea, one might hope again that the autocratic authorities that seem to be in place at the moment would mellow, would soften, and that the Koreans, in their inimitable ways, would find the magic to move on to the more democratic operations within that fascinating nation. The Koreans, again, have, I believe, devotions to the democratic way ingrained in them. And that they would, in their ability to adjust, they would temporarily put up with the inconveniences of the autocratic rule as they develop further economically, and gradually find the ways to shuck off that autocratic core and move more to the, one could, would hope that with the increasing emphasis on literacy in India, that you would get a more alert citizen in the local community that would be very much aware of what was going on in the local community, and perhaps even at the state level. And thus you would have millions of people who would be serving as guardians of the democratic way. In Korea, you must remember that the Koreans have been able, over the centuries, to live under very severe dominating foreign yokes and throw those off with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the Japanese. And so one would hope that better and better educated Koreans would be more adept at throwing off any yokes of control within the national boundaries.
Although one, someone might argue that when you looked at the Soviet Union in 1917, it was a highly illiterate country, and that as it became more and more literate, it in fact became better and better able to control the schools and the political education of its peoples. But just that someone might point out that the literacy argument might not necessarily guarantee any swing towards any particular form of government, or that is, the schools providing literacy training might not particularly guarantee a political form.
It is an input in which I have great confidence, but this is assuming that the content of education is at least that which breeds clear critical thinking, as opposed to that kind of education which is stifling and indoctrinating, you see. Now, the Indian education, as I saw it come up in the 1950s and early 60s, was skewed to the democratic way. Including Mr. Gandhi's prescription of learning by doing, and the whole bit of spinning and the like at the local village level, where you were learning about the nature and importance of your homeland, and you're also learning something about something in connection with skills to help you make a living. Korea came out of the domination of the Japanese with a tremendous thrust and desire to learn and to safeguard the Korean freedom. So it's Well, I hope that in India and Korea that you would get a kind of durability there that would tend to modify and tend to soften the autocratic forces that maybe appear more naturally in situations where the rapidly developing countries are looking for shortcuts to more rapid growth. The problem, you mentioned Indonesia. It's pretty early yet to make predictions or to understand just what's going on. The problem is to get to the grassroots again, to get those national development programs down to the local level, to the cultivator. And in each country, India, Korea, and Indonesia, the societies have long experience with colonialism. India with 2 centuries of colonialism with the United Kingdom, and I've indicated the Korean external domination. Indonesia had 3 centuries of colonialism with the Dutch, and I'm always amazed at the revival power of those societies, how the millions of people have taken hold enthusiastically with the coming of independence. Perhaps the business of reckoning with the time span as a major control is peculiar to the American society. We are addicted to, perhaps favorably, to the business of organizing, designing, executing, and evaluating. And we tend to think of these acts pointed toward development in a time capsule of 1 year, or 2 years, or 5 years, or a decade. And we stress and strain to make those targets. Many other societies are more leisurely, and perhaps more long-suffering than we are. Thinking of the development of an educational system to serve the nation, I've often thought how fortunate we are in the United States, because time, it seems to me, has usually been in our favor. Mm-hmm. We had many decades in our colonial period to develop our primary education. And it was an education that was sort of handmade for the society of the moment. And we had, again, a fairly long period of time to struggle with the problems of developing secondary education and bringing that into a full public school focus. And then the higher education in the same way. And we frequently stand and criticize the rapidly developing nations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, because they're seemingly so slow, and we perhaps think that they ought to be doing in a biennium what we have taken 25 years to do. Mm-hmm. I would hold off for another quarter century and hope that the assistance which the United States has brought to the more rapidly developing countries in the world has a chance to settle in and influence, hopefully favorably, the kinds of societies, always hoping that they will come through on the democratic side. There's something to remember also, and as one works with other countries, that each society has its ways of doing things, and that we oughtn't to be imposing the American ways. We're very impatient to say this works marvelously, and we tend to imply that it's universal mm-hmm. in its applicability, and I'm thinking that Korea has its ways of doing things, and so with the other developing countries around the world.